Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to Turning Towards Life. This is Lizzie and Justin. It's Sunday morning here in London, where Justin and I both are. The sun is shining, and we are here for this episode of our unrehearsed, live, and deeply reorienting conversation about life. I say reorienting because I feel like it brings me under its wing every week, and that we get taken into a place that if we weren't having the conversation, we probably wouldn't otherwise go. And it feels a real blessing to be doing this and to have this continuously week after week feature in my life. And thank you for all of you listening. You might be new here, you maybe have been with us since the very beginning. We're just grateful for everybody sharing in this experience with us and coming along for the conversational ride with us. This week we have a source that Justin has chosen from an article in the Guardian newspaper, which is a newspaper here in the UK. I say newspaper, it's probably not much paper version of it going around anymore, isn't there? But it's a news source. And Justin has chosen this very lovely set of passages. And I think we're going to decide on one part of this because it's quite long. And then we're going to begin our conversation. So Justin, maybe you could say a little bit about how come this source and...
I will. Well, thank you, Lizzie. I'm saying hi to you again and hi to everyone. It's always somebody we know, Lizzie, I can't remember who it was, so forgive me if you're listening, and I don't get this quite right, wrote to us this week. At least I saw a message saying, oh, I really appreciate the way Turning Towards Life is laid out, that we begin with saying hello and sort of feeling into the gratitude of this and then get on with doing the source, and that's sort of the practice that we have. And the truth is, I feel very grateful every time we do this. I feel grateful for you and I feel grateful for this long conversation. I think this is the longest, in a sort of most expansive conversation with a single other person, like consistent, that I've ever been in. We all have conversations that weave their way through our lives, but to purposefully be in conversation with you, Lizzie, is really something. And to know that this is touching many people. And I wanted to say to all of us who are here, thank you for joining. And you're so welcome to tell other people about it if you think that this would be support to them. And anyway, let's get on with the source. So a couple of things that are in the background to this. And one is, this is a piece written by someone called Oliver Berkman, who's been writing in the Guardian newspaper for quite some years. And the way I understand it, Oliver started off with a sort of, let me read books that are intended to help people deeply inquire into life and find out maybe how misguided they are or how shallow they are or something. And he found himself pretty quickly drawn into how much wisdom there is around that can be shared. And sort of this column became a, here's something else I've learned that could help us be in our lives fully, not escape from them, but to really step into them. And he's written for months and months and months. And this was from his last column. And I thought that it distilled in seven or eight different parts some principles that seemed very true and real and awakening. So I wanted to bring it. And the part of this that we're going to read is the part about time. And it's particularly on my mind today, because as I was saying to you before we came on, Lizzie, this morning, it's Jewish New Year this weekend. As we're recording this, it's the second morning of Rosh Hashanah, the two-day New Year festival. And who could have believed this time last year, when we thought ahead to the coming year, that this year would be this way? And the way that we are marking New Year, which normally involves the gathering of large numbers of people in our community together, and of course isn't. It's so different this year to be at home and to be using this same technology we're using for Turning Towards Life to make community together. So it's got me thinking a lot about time and about the passage of time, but also about the way in which we either take the world to be the same, you know, it's always going to be the same next year, or that we try to make it a particular way. And Oliver Berkman wrote brilliantly and beautifully about this in the last part of his article. So this is the one that we'll read. And we've posted a link. If you are on our Facebook group, Turning Towards Life, which you're so welcome to join. If you're not, you can find a link to the full article there in the post. So it's called "The Future Will Never Provide the Reassurance You Seek From It." As the ancient Greek and Roman Stoics understood, much of our suffering arises from attempting to control what is not in our control. And the main thing we try but fail to control, the seasoned worriers among us anyway, is the future. We want to know from our vantage point in the present that things will be okay later on, but we never can. This is why it's wrong to say that we live in especially uncertain times. The future is always uncertain. It's just that we're currently very aware of it. It's freeing to grasp that no amount of fretting will ever alter this truth. It's still useful to make plans, but do that with the awareness that a plan is only ever a present moment statement of intent, not a lasso thrown around the future to bring it under control. The spiritual teacher Jiddu Krishnamurti said his secret was simple: I don't mind what happens. That needn't mean not trying to make life better for yourself or others. It just means not living each day anxiously braced to see if things work out as you hoped.
It's freeing to grasp that no amount of fretting will ever alter this truth. It's still useful to make plans, but do that with the awareness that a plan is only ever a present moment statement of intent, not a lasso thrown around the future to bring it under control. The spiritual teacher Jiddu Krishnamurti said his secret was simple: I don't mind what happens. That needn't mean not trying to make life better for yourself or others. It just means not living each day anxiously braced to see if things work out as you hoped.
Oh my goodness, I know this anxiously braced thing in my body. I mean, so much. That's why I'm so glad for this. Oh, I'm just, the thing I'm doing, for those of you who can't see me, is I'm just sort of wriggling myself out of, seeing if I can relax my own body, because that feeling, Lizzie, of bodily tension that I think I must have had since I was very small. It reminds me of being like a little baby. You know when babies go, you know this because you have a very small person in your lives. You know when babies go, or toddlers go rigid or hold their breaths. Bless you. Lizzie's sneezing away here. I can feel that my body very habitually does a similar kind of thing if I'm not paying attention, which is to tense up and to brace. And I think this language of Oliver's so great here: braced to see if things work out as you hope. So to brace ourselves in life is a physical, it's an orientation, like it's a relationship to life, but it also, at least in my case, so easily manifests as a physical, like, oh, my shoulders are so tight, my jaw is so tight. Why? Oh, because I'm trying to get life to go my way. I've got a picture about how life should be, and I've poured lots of effort, mostly not hugely skillful effort, because the world is so much bigger than me, so how much can I really have life go my way? But I've sort of put a lot of attention into it. Now I'm holding on because it would be terrible if life doesn't go my way. So I know that place really well. And as Oliver Berkman says, it's really full of suffering to live that way, because the first thing is life is actually going to do its thing anyway, which is not to say I don't have any influence. I have a huge amount of influence on lots of things about how I bring myself to my life, but I have very little influence over almost everything else, what the world's actually going to get up to. So it's an incredibly painful situation to be constantly in the difference between my imagined capacity to shape the world and my actual capacity to shape the world. I just get reminded of it all the time, and then I have to brace more and more and more. So that's one part of suffering in it. But the other part of, so and the other suffering that's in it seems to me, at least in my experience, is, so then I'm not really in my life at all when I'm living this way. What I'm constantly in is in a relationship between what I hope and what I fear and what is happening, and noticing the difference between the two all the time, all the time, all the time. Why won't, and it's, and it can, if I'm not paying attention to it, it can very easily dominate everything. Like, you didn't bring me the cereal, you brought me breakfast, but you didn't bring me the cereal just as I wanted it. Like that scale to the big scale, like, oh, I'm not doing the work I imagined I should be doing, or I'm not living in the place I imagined I should be living in, or the political situation isn't how I imagined it, or oh, there's a pandemic and I never planned for this. How dare this happen? So I really know that side, but it's also true to say that I know something of the other side too, which feels to me really deeply related to something we were talking about last week when we were talking about dancing. We got to speaking about dancing with life, is to start to see that life is going to get up to stuff and I'm not in charge. And I can even feel my relief in saying this to you now. I'm not in charge. Oh my goodness. Which doesn't mean giving up, and it doesn't mean stopping taking care, and it doesn't mean working to improve things. It just means seeing that it's a series of dance steps and I can only take the next step in response to what's here, and it's not, most of it's not up to me. Which is why Oliver Berkman's title of his essay is called The Eight Secrets to a Fairly Fulfilled Life. I think it's really sweet. It's like, let's give up on trying to even have our lives be, to force our lives to be fulfilled, but instead see what we can do to open into what's here and then show up in the middle of it. Whatever it's like, that seems to me to be the thing I keep on learning.
It feels very freeing hearing you say all of that. And I felt really moved by what you said at the beginning about what Oliver Berkman has realized, that there are places that we can awaken in our lives. And he started off kind of, sounds to me like you were saying, you know, he started off being a critique of things. And then oops, this is actually really good. And it feels like such a lovely possibility that there is this possibility of awakening. And I like the word awakening because it, in this moment, to me, feels like it. This is, we are in a kind of funny opportunity for awakening, because awakening doesn't solve everything. Just wake up. You know, it's like waking up is a momentary thing. It's like a now thing. So when you said it, I felt like it wasn't a demand on what the future is like what my life is like, but it's something that I can do any moment. And it feels like a really big invitation to wake up. And when I think of waking up, it's doing the opposite of this throwing a lasso around the future to bring it under control. So if I can wake up to the fact that that's what I'm doing, which I know I definitely do. And I think this time with this pandemic happening for me has been a real awakening, because I can't do my normal thing. So normally that life is punctuated with like a plan to go here, a plan to see these people, a plan. I have nothing in my diary, and I haven't had since March or whatever. And it's almost like the world has stopped a practice that wasn't necessarily very good for me. So I didn't even have to stop doing something. It was just stopped for me. And so I'm feeling the effects of stopping planning. And when I say nothing in my diary, of course, there's things, but there aren't the things that I would, like a trip somewhere or having people for dinner, or, you know, the kind of social side of things. I haven't felt that for ages. And so it's had me question, like, well, what, you know, I'm fine without all of the, with all of this, without all of the scaffolding, without all of the lassoing, I'm really okay. So in that sense, it's been a real awakening to what that particular pattern is of lassoing the future and trying to control things by having like a punctuation mark in the midst of this huge future that I can't control, which feels really scary. At least I have, if I have like a thing in a month's time, I can get through a month. I can get through, you know, it's having markers has been like a way of, I think, of feeling in control, and that I haven't got to face the enormity of eternity or something, and the enormity of a future that's completely unknown. At least if I've got a plan, I can know something about something. So I really appreciate this lasso metaphor that he brings us here, because it really shows me how I use that to wrangle and to kind of lessen the enormity of life. And as you say, it then kind of brings about this, well, how is this living up to the thing I projected into the future? And mostly, I have to say, I'm much more satisfied with my version of events than I am with what actually happens in terms of a plan. So I'm always disappointed. It's like a perpetual setup where it never cracks up to be the thing that I fantasized about in my mind. So this awakening also includes, oh, well, I can just be awake to what's here and respond to what's here and see if I can find all the things that I was searching for by doing what I was doing, like being satisfied, feeling fulfilled, there being meaning, all of the things that I feel like I wish for, wondering if there's a different source of that instead of projecting and planning and having the future be the promised land or something.
Such great language. The future being the promised land. That's the sort of deal here, isn't it? It seems to me that we imagine how our lives ought to be, and we extend ourselves very, very hard to try and bring about exactly that life, whether it's the breakfast cereal or the way our friends are when they come around to our house, or the big shape of our lives in 5 years or 10 years, or, you know, whatever it is. As if life were that way, then we would be freed from all of the difficulties and realities of being a human. I think that's sort of part of the fantasy. If I can just get life to go my way, I'll be free of all kinds of suffering. And that itself creates a really intense kind of suffering, just like you said it so beautifully, that you could see how for you it gets you into an always and ever comparison with what's happening, because it wasn't exactly the way that you'd imagined life was going to be. And that's always how life is going to be. It's never going to be exactly. It might be very far from what we've managed, if we've imagined, or it might be quite close but different because somebody else was there. Or, and I can see as we're talking how when I'm in this way, how much it interrupts, like in terms of relationships with other people. Oh, you didn't say to me, I was longing for you to say to me something in this way, and you didn't, and I hadn't asked you to, and I had, but I was longing, and now it's different, and now I feel aggrieved or frightened or irritated or angry or something, all of which are to do with comparisons with how things are. And I was thinking about, whilst you were talking about it, Lizzie, about I thought what you said about it, say, you can see that this saves us from really feeling the actual situation of our lives, the bigness of our lives and the uncertainty of our lives. And that it explains a lot about our culture of busyness that many of us are in, which is that to be busy is to be constantly trying to shape the future. Well, I can't be here now because I've got another thing to do that if I do it will, it feeds this myth, will, if I do this 500 things, then the world will be as I want it.
Yeah.
But because it never is, because we never actually get there, our busyness has does its job of avoiding us feeling the vastness of everything, but also is never, ever, ever satisfied. We can't give up on it because it never produces the thing that we're looking for. And so the response to this that's life-giving is to learn. I think the first place to learn, at least this is what I found in my life, is to have practices that stop me bracing.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, a really simple, the one that's so powerful for me is just a simple sitting meditation practice. I just sit for a while and feel what it's really like to be in my life and feel how uncertain things are and feel how anxious I am. So first of all, to allow myself to feel all of that, but also to feel how beautiful things are and how much capacity I have and how much I love and how glad I can be and how grief-filled I can be. That learning to be in contact with all of that, learning to feel it and to not be pushing it away by bracing my body and clenching my jaw and narrowing my heart and demanding of life, has this deeply paradoxical effect, which maybe isn't so paradoxical now I say it, that it's also possible from there to receive my life. To actually have my life be my life, not the thing that I'm just sort of putting up with until the future that I've imagined comes about, but it is actually my life. And when I can feel my life here, it doesn't mean that I just give up on taking care of stuff. In fact, the opposite. I feel like I take care of stuff much more genuinely, knowing that my attempts to take care won't always bring about what I want, but I still feel called to take care of people I love and projects that are important and all of that.
As you say that, Justin, I can kind of reconnect with the bodiliness of me, that when I know that the future is a thing I'm trying to control, and it's a kind of internal pushing in my chest that's, I can feel myself forcing my way kind of into life, like leaning forward, kind of almost like, you know, if I had a present body, my present body would be about 4 meters in front of me and I'm trying to kind of catch up or something. And I can feel that internal pressure to be going faster than I'm going, or managing things more efficiently, or, you know, there's a kind of, as you say, like a comparison thing in the moment of, well, it should be like this, I'm just going to keep trying to make it like that all the time. And me too, like just seeing who I am right now and what's happening right now and coming back into this moment feels like a kind of continual observation of myself and a continual practicing simultaneously of like returning backwards into myself, like having a relationship to my back, knowing that my whole world isn't just this kind of somethingness in front of me, but that there's all of my body and all the way to my spine that exists too. So I feel like I, in my future focused self, I live kind of one step in front of myself. And there's a pushing in my physical body to kind of get me there. And it really is a kind of asleep. You know, again, I would say like an awakening moment for me is taking a breath and stepping back. And from a step backness, I can see so much more. I can feel more. I can experience, like you say, like my life, not some dragged around kind of life that's really not much to do with me at all. And I find this happening as well with Vespa, who's now 10 and a half months old. I keep having this thing of like, well, who's she going to be? And who's she going to turn out to be? And it's a lovely wondering, but it also has this weird thing where it kind of, I think, well, am I just in service to who she's going to turn out like? Or is this moment inherently where everything is? And so she helps me always to return to like, well, just who we are right now is enough. Like, I haven't got to do this in service of something bigger and some kind of future. She's got to turn out like that, and therefore I've got to do this now. But just to trust and be right here in the 10-monthness of things and letting that be what it is, and being really contactful and not calculating things and not trying to make it all okay for the future. Like, well, what's she going to turn out like if I do that? And what's she going to turn out like if we do that? And we're just to be right here. And that letting that be of value in itself, rather than it being of value because it's for something else.
Yeah. So what you're saying brings in the whole possibility that we might have an eye on the future because we want to take care of things that we think are going to matter to us, but we can get so caught up in living a life that is only about the future and is never for its own sake.
Mm.
And there's something very important about seeing that things can be for their own sake and that this moment can be for its own sake.
Mm.
But when I read this piece by Oliver Berkman, he mentions the Greek and Roman Stoics at the start, and I've read a little bit of Marcus Aurelius, who was a Roman emperor, who was a Stoic, who kept these private journals that I don't think he ever thought would be published, but now, you know, people found them, and they're full of amazing wisdom about all of this. And he, at one point, he writes that we think that a much longer life is much better than a shorter life. And he says, but that's a mistake, because actually in our lives, however long we've lived and however long we might have to live, we all only actually have the same thing, which is this moment here, in which we carry our memory of the past and our hopes for the future. But but we're not so different to one another. If you've been alive for 70 years or 3 months, you still have exactly the same thing, which is an arising experience right here. And it seemed to me that when you were talking about waking up, it's very resonant for me, this being Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year, because there's this phrase in all of the liturgy for the Jewish New Year about return. Mm-hmm. There's a word that keeps on cropping up, which really means return. And what it means is returning to our own lives, like turning back into our lives. Waking up to all the ways that we've abandoned our lives because we got so controlling and we got so big. I think one of the things we're talking about here that I'm trying to find my way into, Lizzie, is also right-sizing ourselves in our lives that we've talked about before, is actually, I'm not so big that I can control the future. So let me give up that project, which just has me some distance from my own life, like you said.
Mm.
And that also means not trying to control the people around me so that they, like my children, so that they just become a project of my way of controlling the future. But what a thing to do to one another, to make one another into a means by which the future I want gets brought about. No, yes. Like Vespa, and she's a real person with her own unfolding life that has such sweet and deep value right now. And we can just forget all of that by making ourselves way too big. But the other thing that we do is we think that if we don't make ourselves that big, then I'll end up very, very, very tiny, and life will be meaningless, and I'll have no place in life, and I'll be overwhelmed. And actually, I think it's the opposite. I think that when we wake up to our lives in this way, we find ourselves really the appropriate size in our lives, which is, I'm actually a participant in this moment. There are many choices about how I bring myself to this moment. I'm part of an unfolding process of relationships that I'm right in the midst of. How am I going to bring myself to this rather than how am I going to brace myself against this so that I can get something else that I want?
Yeah.
So it feels very kind of feel the softness in this, but also the proper hopefulness in this, and in this for me as we're talking about it, which is not hopefulness that the world will turn out the way I want it, but more that I can bring myself into my life, however it is. That's the work, is to bring ourselves into our lives right now, however they are.
Mm. Yeah, I was thinking as you were talking, Justin, I some people really hate surprise things, but I really love surprise things because this thing doesn't happen. I'm basically just trotting along, and something nice happens that I didn't organize, I didn't plan, I didn't project onto, I didn't fantasize about. It's just erupting in the moment. And I recognize how much I love that, because it has me have an experience of the right-sizingness. which is, well, I could just live life as if it's all a surprise, because it is, isn't it? It's like everything is a surprise, especially if I haven't tried to lasso the hell out of it to be what I think it is or what I think it should be. And I feel like it's this new little mini narrative's emerging for me of like, what if I could be the vibe of surprise wherever I am, to see things with fresh eyes and in the unplannedness, just meet whatever's here with a joyful curiosity about what is this? And that feels like the invitation of treating a future like this, is that I could live life as a surprise.
Oh, Izzy, that's such an amazing place to end. I can feel the impact on me of what you said. Why not live life as if everything were a surprise, because it is.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. It's so kind. It's such a kind way. And then I was thinking about this conversation. This conversation is always a surprise because we have no idea where it's going to go. It's like practicing. It's practicing this, not trying to make it, you know, shiny or complete or comprehensible or something. We're just letting it come. So I'm very glad for this practice.
Yeah.
But what an invitation, because it also means that even what we've taken to be routine, humdrum and mundane, we could approach as if it were surprise. What would it be to let ourselves be surprised by the mug of tea that is here, and to live probably much more fittingly in something more of a state of radical amazement and wonder at the radical openness and uncertainty and consequently creativity of our lives in every moment, which is what we can't do when we're clenched jawed, you know, tight ribbed, trying to lasso life into a particular form.
And living life as a surprise is like, it's that you can receive something then, because it's like you haven't premeditated anything. So I feel like the receptivity thing really opens up when I imagine my life's a series of surprises. Like, And actually somebody said to me the other day about Vespa, they said, my neighbour always says, oh my gosh, babies are just full of surprises. And it's true. She surprises me all the time. Because I don't know, I've never been a parent before. I don't know what's going to happen.
But it turns out that everyone's full of surprises if we'll just look, including ourselves.
Yes.
And life itself. Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, Lizzie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I feel so blessed to be in this conversation. I'm really lucky.
Yeah, me too.
And I'm going to go on into the rest of Rosh Hashanah, of Jewish New Year, with this opening to everything being surprising. Carry it through into the coming weeks and months and see what comes from it. And we'll be back next week, all being well. We may have to announce a slightly different time because we're teaching again, you and I, and we'll have to figure out quite what that means. And for those of you who are new or have been with us for a while, next week is the last week of our third year of this project. So it feels like a significant time just to be marking what we've been up to, Lizzie, and also for everyone who's coming with us for however long they've been with us.
Yeah.
So we'll see you then. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.